friends and listeners, and welcome to a new format. Hello, Ike. It's great to have you here as well. We are doing some new experience for the first time here, the kind of thing that we announced about, 6 weeks ago?
Yeah, just about now, and I'm very excited for our first episode. This is very special to me. I'm glad to be here, and we've got some excellent guests today.
Absolutely. And for those who are not on video, I think we have to explain. So Arcanum Podcast, the Great Arcanum Podcast, and Thoth Hermes Podcast are starting a series of common podcasts once a month. I think we are gonna run that kind of double interview with two guests each time. And yes, as you say, we have two great guests here today. Do you would like to introduce the two?
Sure. Our conversation today is with Phoenix Aurelius of the Phoenix Aurelius Research Academy. He's a practicing alchemist, an educator, and a researcher. And with Daniel Wiseman of Secret Fire Apothecary. He's also an excellent, highly lauded practical alchemist, researcher, and educator. And what's really going to facilitate our roundtable discussion, I think, today is that Phoenix and Daniel are not only colleagues, but they're friends.
Right. And still they are a bit of two generations almost. I think Daniel being the younger of the two. And that makes it also interesting because I think we will see the development in practical alchemy. And what I also be curious to hear, because I think normally, and many of our listeners don't even think of that in the first place, because of course, like me, they're not specialists in alchemy, the difference that there is between alchemy and spagyrics. I mean, it's not the same thing in a way. And I think we're going to explore that quite a bit.
Yeah, and it's great because they, you know, since alchemy really is a part of the broader esoteric tradition, I mean, both Western and Eastern, it'll be really nice to hear from two people that have a background in not just alchemy, but broader traditions as well, both East and West. And you know, not to delve too much into sports commentary here, but they're guys at the top of their game right now. You know, they're on the cutting edge, they're doing work, and they're very, very hungry for what they do. And I really, it's inspiring to see people who practice at this level.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should give our listeners here some practical advice, because as it is a first, they have to discover. So this podcast and the ones that will follow those common just joint ventures that we are doing together will be broadcast on both our channels, on all the outlets that you, Ike, use for the Arcanum podcast, and on all the outlets that I use on the Thoth Hermes podcast. So you can spread the word widely, and we will really hope that you are all going to enjoy this. If you want to give us some feedback, use the regular things, use the feedback that you're used to have for Canon Podcast or for Thoth Hermes Podcast, and we'll exchange them. Don't you worry. You will reach both of us when you write to either of us about this podcast, don't we? and I think we should also keep up you. You asked me for that. I'm happy to do that. We take up the musical tradition of the Thoth Hermes podcast. So we will play some music here today as well.
Absolutely. Yes, that's one of my favorite features about this. I don't really do that on the Arcanum podcast. And it's definitely one of my favorite things about the Thoth Hermes podcast as well. So maybe we could start with our musical intro.
Yes, absolutely. So let me explain what is going to come. Right, so this month's music choice is from here in Europe, not actually from here in Vienna, but from Norway. Lefty and the Tin Can Sellers is the project based around the Norwegian songwriter Kjell Anders Hotvedt. And besides him being a songwriter and singer, Kjell Anders Hotvedt is an organic farmer, a writer and poet. And he is also one of the fans of the Thoth Hermes podcast. And he has sent me the music a couple of months ago. And I'm very happy to give it to all us here tonight. It's Very nice. Kjell's background is in education and literature, philosophy, Latin and ecology, and his music is inspired by folk music from every nook and cranny of the world, and the lyrics is bent towards esoteric mysticism and folklore. So listen carefully to what you will hear. And the first song that we hear is named Ocean Floor. Ocean Floor by Lefty and the Tin Can Sellers, with their lead singer Kjell Anders Holtvedt.
There's a sliver of light in the crack of dreams that reminds me of the evening. When the queen of every lark and eve gave the earth back to meaning. In the journey through the gleaming, you cannot walk alone. There's a door in every meeting, it creaks once, then it's gone. It's a slippery hand I'm holding, you cannot hold as long as the war of thoughts keeps raging, 100 legions strong. Swans approach the ocean floor. One dives, the other's sinking. In the journey through the gleaming, you cannot walk alone. There's a door in every meeting, creaks once, then it's gone. It's a slippery hand I'm holding, you cannot hold as long as the war of thoughts keeps raging, 100 legions strong.
Well, welcome to our first roundtable discussion with myself, Ike Baker, and my distinguished podcast partner, Rudolf Berger of the Thoth Hermes podcast.
Hello there.
Yeah, it's great to be here with you, Rudolf. Hopefully this will be the first of many. And we've got a couple of excellent guests that we're going to have a conversation with this evening. Phoenix Aurelius of the Phoenix Aurelius Research Academy. He's a practicing educator and alchemist. And Daniel Wiseman of Secret Fire Apothecary, also a practicing alchemist and an educator. I'm really thrilled to be among this company this evening. I think we're going to have a great conversation.
It's a great moment to kick it off during equinox of spring, right? Yeah, it's great to have you all here, and also to have two alchemists who practice, and we will hopefully find out during the conversation also the differences between your approaches, if there are any. And it's always, I think that's the interesting thing when we do those double talks, that we have people who are on the same line but not quite, and might show us what differences could be and also should be, because that's what makes life interesting and more colorful. So how do you know one another, Daniel?
I mean, I came across Phoenix's work in my very early days into alchemy and spagyrics, probably at least a decade ago, maybe pushing a little bit further. I'm starting to lose track of time, but, Phoenix, I think, is quite prominent, especially in the North American spagyric tradition. So his work was kind of front and center when I started leaving the books and getting into the online community. He was one of the first people that I came across, watching some of his old podcasts and checking out what he had on his social media. And then it wasn't until, a few years later, we shared some banter back and forth online on a few subjects. And eventually Phoenix invited me on his show. And the rest is history, I guess.
Yeah, like you said, like 10 years ago, so this would have been probably like the early Facebook groups, if I remember right. Insta wasn't really a thing at that time. And I remember that all of the Yahoo groups from like a decade earlier had all kind of fizzled out by that time, of actual practical alchemists like having back and forth conversations. That's how I learned so much, though, in those early days. And so I always wanted to contribute as much as I could for other folks as I learned more. And I was contributing pretty heavily in those days to those Facebook forums. To turn the phrase that Ike mentioned earlier, it's rare as hen's teeth that I will actually post much of anything these days, because it got highly contentious, as most things did over the last 3 or 4 years due to global situations. But before that, there was this kind of golden era of really great people who were posting a lot of high level things. And so it was really awesome. One day, as I was making posts or just kind of scrolling through there, I saw Dan Wiseman's stuff coming up, and I was like, this guy, he's put in the time. Like, I can tell that he knows what he's talking about. And he was coming at it from angles that were absolutely unique and that other people weren't talking about. He still does. I think he's one of the pioneers of modern alchemy, especially, like he said, for me, especially in North America. But I was just really, really wholeheartedly impressed. And so, like he said, we had some discussions and sharing thoughts and possibly even minor arguments or whatever online for a little while, and then eventually invited him to come on the podcast, on the Alchemical Trip podcast. And that's when I was like, this guy is top notch. I mean, I already knew that, but like the information he has and how he presents it is fantastic. So a lot of respect for Dan.
Likewise.
That's really nice. I'm warm and fuzzy now. Well, yeah. You know, the interesting thing for me, as Rudolf mentioned earlier, I do want to get into how you both are unique. And I think that I have some idea about that, but I'd like to hear your own thoughts, right? I mean, that's kind of interesting when you put somebody on the spot. So I want to get there, but first let's lay a little groundwork here. Phoenix, you mentioned the modern alchemical scene. when do you think modern alchemy, like when you conceptualize it now, and as you've used the term in conversation, when do you think that really began? And what would you say are the keystones of the modern alchemical community, or maybe a better word is paradigm?
Sure. Well, being where I'm at in Utah and having the experience that I've had, my reference point for where the modern alchemical kind of community, or where the term modern alchemy really comes from, and this is a very American answer. If you're in anywhere besides maybe America, pockets of Switzerland and Australia, you will probably have a much different experience than me. But I would say that when Frater Albertus first opened Paracelsus College, that would have been the first time that we really saw what modern alchemy was, the way that we look at it and conceive of it today. The way that Robert Allen Bartlett was taught, and his predecessor, of course, being Frater Albertus, the way that they were taught was just a very unique offspin off of the Rosicrucian work that was being taught at San Jose, California. And I think his name was Orson Graves, was the guy who taught the alchemy course within the Amorque tradition. And he worked with Frater Albertus actually for a while. And it was when they closed down the alchemy lab of PR or of at San Jose, Rosicrucian Park. Frater saw that there was a need for this work to be continued. And he, as story was passed on to me, ended up opening that up. And then he taught such a wide variety of people in the 24 years or thereabouts that he had his doors open, that he was definitely reaching a huge number of the people that have created written works that we have stuff available from today in the English language. And so the way that I see it was that Frater kind of began this community, and then after them, the philosophers of nature with Jean Dubuis's work, which was translated by Patrice Malaise, a couple of Canadian guys. And they ended up creating a kind of an echo chamber of those very same principles in the lab work. Like everybody who was part of both schools says that the curriculum was basically the same. The tradition was basically the same, with few peculiarities thrown in there by Jean Dubuis's, you know, own mystical experience or whatever. So the way that I see it and my experience with it would say that it kind of began with Frater Albertus in the early days of Paracelsus College, extending through Paracelsus Research Society, and then with Philosophers of Nature, and kind of dying with Philosophers of Nature too, when they actually, you know, got rid of the egregore of Philosophers of Nature. It was the death of something for a while inside of the in the entire alchemical community. There was a real need and a sense for culture that suddenly just dropped and was not available. And it took a little while to pick that up. And it's still not as cohesive as it was in those days. It was a really cool moment, snapshot in time, as far as I can tell. So anyway, that's my answer.
You have to bear with me to be the European voice here, because of course I have that being over here. I have that point of view. Would you see, Daniel, a major difference in approach or in history on the East Coast where you are, in Canada in particular, than from maybe Utah, and the history coming from Amorque and from the West Coast? Has the development been parallel or being the same, or do you see any difference on that side of the continent?
I think Phoenix described it well. I think really there was a bit of an echo chamber created in this new modern paradigm where everybody was essentially teaching the same things, whether it came from Frater Albertus or Philosophers of Nature or Manfred Junius as well, who of course isn't on the same side of the pond as us, but you see the same thread of teachings with some tweaks, just like Jean Dubuis had his European influences and had some other, you know, unique material. I feel like it's very similar. You know, my paradigm, or what was available to me and to Phoenix, I'd say that the big difference now, if I could expand upon our modern paradigm, is now we have the internet, you know, and so the internet, although there's been a big void for, you know, long lasting schools, the internet has created this new era, which is contentious, as Phoenix mentioned, which I think it's, you know, it's a little bit awkward sometimes, but I think it's an important phase of the modern paradigm, because now we have a lot more debate. And you see that a lot between people who are very much aligned with traditional alchemical thought, and then the new paradigm of like spagyrics as per Frater Albertus or Manfred Junius or now Robert Bartlett, you know, a continuance of that thought. You see a lot of clashing in between people, which, you know, is not always great. But I think when it's done respectfully is a really important part right now, is comparing and contrasting these traditions, finding links between them, and really validating where these ideas came from, like what's new, what's old, where do they meet in the middle. I think there's a lot more meeting in the middle than maybe some people would have you believe. But I think that's an important part of this new paradigm is the internet, where so many people can connect over this. You know, there's Facebook groups like the Alchemy Study page, which I believe has over 40,000 people on it, right? So now we're into a phase where alchemy is more available to the world than any other time. You know, we have so much resource between networking and reference material too, you know, because there's so much published material that, you know, nobody at any other time had access to. So we've got this, you know, this common modern problem of information saturation. We have so much to distill down and to try to understand what is the truth of this matter. And of course, there's lots of strong opinions in that, and that can spark some really great debates to kind of hash out what's true and what's false, which I think is really what alchemy is all about.
I wanted to piggyback off of a point or some terms that you use there, because truly I'm very interested in it. As you might have may or may not know, I've looked into the history of it and of alchemy. It's extremely fascinating to me. But you know, I think Phoenix and I have described it as the fever dream forest in the past. It's labyrinthine, and it can be very, very confusing. But if you had to, maybe for our audience or for me, if you had to compare and contrast, well, let's start out with contrasting. I think that's the best way to really distinguish them. What are the major, I guess, bullet point differences between the, you know, contemporary and the ancient alchemical paradigms? Like what defines the work you're doing now as opposed to the things alchemists were doing, you know, maybe 400 or 500 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll start it by saying that my personal take is that there are many, many hallways to the same room. So again, I think there's a lot more convergence of ideas, or should be more convergence of ideas than these ideas opposing one another. But if you look at the essence of the contrast would be, traditional alchemy is generally focused on a polarity of two different things, or those two polarities being split into the four elements. Whereas more modern alchemy, as Frater Albertus taught it, and all the other people that kind of sprung from that, are focused on, you know, the Paracelsian idea of the tria prima. So you've got, you know, one system that's sulfur and mercury, these opposites, and then sometimes split into the elements. And then the tria prima. So that to me is probably the main difference between this traditional versus more relatively new paradigm of alchemy, at least since Paracelsus.
And would you say, Phoenix, that what you described as this new paradigm, and which happened over the last few years, and the discussion that Daniel mentioned between those two groups, is still on a discussion on that same difference? Or is there anything else that the last years or the last 20 years, let's say, have brought to the discussion, something that has become even more different than those two ancient differences, so to speak?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, I think to be perfectly honest with you, the same amount of evolution in alchemical thought and ideas that happened between 1530 and 1960 happened between 1960 and about 1990. And I think that same amount of growth has probably happened in the alchemical community starting around 2007 till maybe about 2015 or so. It was that same, like, several hundred years of alchemical thought and evolution was now speeding up to this, which then kind of sped up this way. And right now, I mean, my head is spinning all the time. There's no possible way that I can keep up with everything that's published and everything that's posted on various alchemical groups across all different social media platforms and online sources. I mean, it is really insane to see how many different practices are coming up, and people are actually bringing their own thing to it, for better and for worse. I think the better thing is that it drives diversity, and it's going to drive tradition. And just like anything, when there's, you know, when something gets oversaturated, certain colors still make their way to the surface. They might be darker than what they would be otherwise, but they are still very definitively colored one particular way. And so, you know, the cool thing is that there's a lot of diversity to the art right now. The possible thing that we see, though, is dilution, as the negative aspect of that is that some of the more traditional ideas and concepts are, I can't say they're losing hold because it's still the vast majority of what's being used, but it has this kind of adverse parallel form that is getting developed. And, you know, to a certain degree, this has always happened, but when people are very fresh or very green to something, they start teaching it without fully really knowing what they're talking about. There happens to be a sense of like dilution and insertion of ideas to fill in the blanks of what, you know, their own perception is of this thing, instead of kind of connecting it more to what is the hermetic lineage of this and how am I passing on these more kind of like lineage based ideas. So there's both good and bad, but what I see about it right now, what kind of my stance on it and how I'm dealing with that, is that I'm starting to just call my work, like, this is Aurelian alchemy, meaning that people will know that that comes from my tradition and I'm teaching this, and this is just one tradition of many different traditions that can exist. Same thing with the concept of Aurelian Spagyria, and the alchemical works and the Spagyric works, you know, they're similar, but the idea within, again, Aurelian philosophy, my philosophy, would be that alchemy is more a path of self-initiation into nature, whereas Spagyria is a medicinal application of the alchemical arts and sciences with a broader kind of medicinal art foundation to it. But that's not everybody's stance, and that's not everybody's take.
The material manifestation of the spiritual work, would that be a term which fits to Spagyrics?
Yeah, I mean, realistically, the spirit and the soul, the spirit and the psychological work, the spiritual and psychological work are happening with the physical material all the time. So, like, you know, when, as alchemists, that's what we're trying to do, is use our lab work first to be able to serve as a model for those changes that nature makes, to be able to learn from that. But in that, the material that we have that we're working with is a spirit, a soul, and a body. And those correspond to some aspect of our spirit, soul, and body. And so when we're opening up, say, materials in a plant or in a mineral, you know, the more fixed the material is that you're working with, you tend to have a more serious or more archetypal type of deeper archetypal effect on the individual. And it begins to change, at least in my experience, looking at this and performing alchemy with this intent, by the way, my experience is that we end up kind of changing aspects of ourselves or transforming aspects of ourselves in direct relationship to the materials that we're working with, at least if we're open to that concept. And that's what really differentiates alchemy from Spagyria, in my opinion, in a certain regard, is that Spagyria is done with an attitude that everybody can take this. This is for everybody. And it becomes somewhat of a, I don't want to decrease the value, but it's somewhat of a primitive chemical approach to making things. And it's not really that primitive. So I don't know why I want to say that. I guess it's just a non-pharmaceutical kind of approach to it. But alchemy is more of like you're using your work to help comprehend the spiritual, psychological, and physiological significance of the transformation of the work at hand. And in my opinion, that if it's done correctly or done with good amount of awareness, it elicits those changes. So most of the modern alchemists that I know of kind of approach their work in a somewhat similar way to that, or would have a somewhat similar philosophy. Although there are plenty who also do have like a Golden Dawn based tradition or other things like that, where it's like a Rosicrucian tradition where they're also, you know, doing what is called spiritual or psychological alchemy. But for any practical alchemist, it's really merged. It's not a separate practice. And eventually, hopefully, we just learn how to carry that into other aspects or all aspects of our life, that same type of state of awareness and significance.
I like that you, that was one of my questions was going to be for you. How do you define Aurelian alchemy? And I think that you set it up really nicely there and incorporated this idea of body, spirit, soul, the tria prima, kind of correspondences there, that Daniel mentioned. But I'm interested now, Daniel, what is Secret Fire Apothecary all about? What are you doing that's unique, in the modern paradigm? How do you define your work?
Well, I mean, a big part of my work is clinical, and I think that kind of speaks to the conversation we're having right now too, is that there's I think a big effort in our modern times to share, which is quite different than, say, the traditional history. It's a lot more open than it has been throughout the history of alchemy. You see, you know, more people coming to light that want to teach, or they want to sell their products to people who want to better their health with these things. So, I mean, my background, like I come from a clinical perspective. I'm a clinical herbalist. So, you know, my initiation into this really was about creating, you know, a working apothecary with spagyric and alchemical medicines that I can use in my private practice. So that's one aspect of it. I think another unique aspect of it would be research. You know, I'm heavily involved and interested by validating alchemy with our modern tools and methodologies. I think in my experience thus far, the ultimate sign of truth is when philosophy and science are entirely congruent with one another. And that's been the biggest eye openers for me in my path. And, you know, it ruffles feathers and makes other people excited, but, you know, trying to use the best of what we have around us to validate and further our path, I think, is what anybody would have done along this path. If you look at the writers of, you know, all these traditional writers, they were using the scientific method to the best of their ability as well. And they were using it alongside their philosophical or even religious ideas as kind of like their tether to the path that they were on. You know, they may have this deeper spiritual purpose behind their work, but they were not afraid of using science as far as they could at that time to validate their results, you know, repeating things over and over again, using just observation, taking really great notes and seeing what things really added up and what things didn't. So I think that's something that I'm really focused on. So it's not really a new idea, but I think in a lot of ways it is, because our tool belt has expanded quite a bit since, you know, 1,000 years ago. So the ability to analyze what we have in a third party lab, you know, to say, what are we really creating here? What works, what doesn't, what are some misconceptions, which would be obviously there'll be misconceptions when we had limited tools, in the past, you know, just really sorting out what survives the fire. In this case, the fire is analysis. You know, certainly I'm not trying to disprove alchemy. And the more and more I pull modern science into my practice, the more and more it's validated, you know, by this type of research that I'm doing. So that to me is, you know, is really the fire underneath of me that keeps me going is research and validating these different methodologies and what they can produce. And in particular, in a clinical sense, why is it that these methods make such effective and powerful and often quite safe medicines? Like, what is it about the chemistry of this philosophy and laboratory practice is so special and unique from, you know, modern pharmacy or even a lot of, you know, modern herbal medicine?
Well, of course, the Rosicrucian tradition often speaks of the secret fire. So did you take it from there? Let's be blunt, or did you develop your own thought about it?
Well, I took it from a lot of sources. I think that's a big thing that stuck out for me with Secret Fires, that, you know, it's mentioned from so many different paths, and often it's mentioned with, you know, different names for it. But for me, it's the essence of what we're doing. It's like the reason why. It's the thing that's animating everything. It's this universal principle that is making everything go and giving you a reason for why you want to be alive and pursue whatever it is you're pursuing, whether that be alchemy or anything else in life. So I thought, you know, what is more important than that, that animating spark of existence? You know, that's to me the most important thing perhaps about this work is keeping your eye on that prize.
So my thought is this, right? As somebody, you know, I'm a ceremonialist, and I know you both have background in that kind of stuff. And to your point earlier, Phoenix, on the point of on initiation and the idea that the spagyrics are, you know, these medicinal preparations using the principles of alchemy are for everyone. Do they contain a potency that is, I guess, comparable to what the initiatic alchemist might undergo, you know, like, do they have any sort of initiatic, do they catalyze that experience? So let's just say if somebody were to take some of the spagyric tinctures and things like this, these preparations, would that then catalyze the species of initiation for themselves? Or is it strictly kind of an anatomical, you know, biophysiological sort of thing?
Well, my answer to that is, I guess, you know, I have to answer that a couple of different ways. Within my philosophy, the goal is when I'm making a spagyric tincture over here to not include anything other than the intelligence of the plant. I'm trying not to put myself into there. As the operator, I just want to have the highest vitality that I can and be able to know the processes so fluidly that I can help that plant express itself in the most exalted way that I know how. And so I'm trying to leave any initiatic effect that that material might have to the plant itself. And I do think that plants, through the spagyric art, have the ability to convey their messages and their initiation to the individual. And also the item of pharmacopoeia that we use has different initiatic systems to it as well. So, like, this would be the second part to my answer, is that if I give somebody a spagyric tincture, that's probably going to be more physiological. If somebody takes an essence, that's going to be more psychological. If it's going to be like a fermented essence or something like a magistery, where the mercury seems to be the vast majority of the constitution of that particular remedy, then that's going to have a very mercurial effect on the individual in terms of working on their spirit and things like that. So depending on the item of pharmacopoeia and what percentage sulfur, mercury, and salt are in and what form they show up in, I think really determines how that remedy is going to work. There are also things known as initiatics, which are specifically designed by the practitioner to create an initiatic experience. So there's a lot of different ways of answering that. And I think it really depends on which item of pharmacopoeia and who the preparer is and what their intention and or kind of ritual preparation of it actually entails.
Phoenix, you mentioned Golden Dawn before. We were talking about Rosicrucianism, and also, of course, like Ike, I'm also ceremonial from on that end. There is a certain school in those teachings that says you have to do things with your hands. You have to make your wand. You have to create things with not only with your spirit, with your thinking, but with your body, with your hands, to prepare things physically. How does that teaching compare, or maybe I should broaden that question, how does occultism as a scheme, how does it compare to what you just said about the difference between spiritual alchemy and spagyrics? So could one say that preparing a medicine is like creating an object that you need in ceremonial magic, for example, or does that not compare at all? Is this a completely different concept?
I can only answer, I guess, for myself, but in general, the way that I teach, the tradition that I pass on, is that would be more of the alchemical work. I would compare the alchemical work much more similar to the preparation of ceremonial magical things, because you're imbuing it for you. This, nobody is going to be using your ceremonial tools besides you, hopefully. And so you are putting yourself into those tools in the same way that, like, a bladesmith who's talented pours himself into the blade that he's making, if it's for himself or a loved one. It's like that type of thing, right? And that seems to be more of the alchemical path. For me, we do things in alchemy because we are undergoing an initiation. And so even if the work is a little bit sloppy, if you're investigating it for the first time or trying to put multiple different pathways together from different authors and kind of, spin off and do your own thing, it can be a little bit messy, but it is definitely something that you're pouring your entire love into, your entire self into, for that discovery. You put into things what you get out of things what you put into them. With the alchemical work, I find myself and teach others to put themselves into that work wholly, because then you really get a tremendous amount out of it. You're a totally different person by the end of the work if you're paying attention and actually doing, using quantum state of observation throughout the process. That being said, the spagyric work we try to keep ourselves out of. So I would compare spagyric work in a certain regard to somebody who's an alchemist and knows the work, like the back of their own hand, can step into a spagyric lab and do this thing as a daytime job. That would kind of be the way that I approach this.
I think, I agree in essence with everything being said. At the same time, I feel, whether it be spagyrics or alchemy, the thing about this, one of the things that drew me to this is the holism about it, the holistic aspect of it. There's, of course, there's separation of things. We can separate the individual endeavor from the more communal endeavor. We separate all these parts of the substances, but we know that they're made from one thing, and in the end they're going to go back to one thing. So in the end, I think the lines get a little bit blurry about, the individual approach versus a more communal clinical approach. Is a medicine more physical, or is it more psychological or even initiatic? I think that all of these factors are kind of always at play. And, the operator, I think, is maybe one of the first steps of how you can kind of direct this work, based on your intentions, right? I mean, if your intention is to create a purely initiatic substance for yourself or even others, maybe in a private group or something like that, of course, you have that ability as the operator to fine tune the process for that. But in the end, even the most, you know, individualistic efforts, I find they're mirrored in the work of sharing medicine, right? Medicine is a, you know, it's a spiritual endeavor, I think, in the end, when you look at the root of illness, regardless of whether you're helping a neighbor get rid of their annoying headache or dealing with something, you know, more obviously deeper. In the end, all of our ailments come from a deeply spiritual place. So I think, you know, we can separate these things in some sense to make sense of it and to talk about it and also to program our work in a certain way. But in the end, I feel like it's a bunch of streams, you know, leading into the same river. I said earlier, different hallways into the same room. It's unavoidably spiritual and physical and emotional and individualistic and communal all at the same time, which is, I think, really what I love about alchemy, is that holism. It doesn't go too far really into any of those individual pieces, because without including everything, then it's not alchemy, right? If you remove an essential piece of it, then you're missing an essential ingredient, right? So you're going to fail at some point. So it's a difficult question to answer in some ways, because it's yes and no, it's up and down, left and right, it's polarized, but it's all one thing. So that's kind of my take on that, you know, because for me, like, for an example, like, I'm focused largely upon clinical work, so sharing medicine with people, or sharing even research with people. But of course, as anybody who does this work knows, as you do this, regardless of whether the intention may be to share with other people, like, you go through your own individual trials and tribulations along the way. I feel like it's an unavoidable part of the work, and also something I love about it, because it's, you know, very, very busy, like Phoenix mentioned at the beginning. And it's so great to be able to get my work done and my spiritual work done all in the same motion, you know, everything is kind of feeding back to the same place. So yeah, it's an interesting question, and I think about it a lot, actually.
Okay, and now we are taking a musical break, and this musical break brings us back to Lefty and the Tin Can Sellers with songwriter Kjell Anders Hotved, and the next piece we are going to listen to is called Trail of Breadcrumbs. And as you might remember, for those of you who follow Thoth Hermes, I will immediately announce also the third song, which we will play after the end of the second part of our roundtable talk on alchemy here today. So the third piece that we're going to hear afterwards again by Lefty and the Tin Can Sellers is called Seaweed. So once again, now, Trail of Breadcrumbs. Then we carry on with our interesting roundtable discussion. And at the end of that, you are going to hear Seaweed once again by this band led by Kjell Anders Hotved.
It's been snowing all leaves. It's been covering up the tracks beneath. An unearthly glow shakes through this purplish conflict. Oh, there's room mistaken for the hills. Trail made of breadcrumbs was eaten by mice, but mistakes.
once, you must surely do twice what's been guiding my hand through this snow-crested land. Is a rumor from beneath the sand. Scattered old buds, like a pack without herds, all my thoughts are harnessed by the wind. Well, there's a faint drop of sin from your hairlock within. It's being carried on by snow and wind. The trail made of breadcrumbs was eaten by mice. What mistakes you did once, you must surely do twice. What's been guiding my hand through this snow-crested land is a rumor from beneath the sand.
I loved the fact that Rudolph mentioned, you know, having to make stuff by hands, because even you look at Zosimus of Panopolis in the 3rd and 4th century CE, before, you know, alchemia became an actual term, he called it chirokmeta, which meant things made by hand. And I love, you know, the correlation, especially Phoenix talking about not putting too much of yourself into the preparation. It's very similar to magic. You know, not putting too much of yourself into a divination, not putting too much of yourself into a talismanic stuff is very important there too. That's why I'm a firm believer that you shouldn't make talismans for other people, because there's going to be some kind of energetic connection there. Even if you're doing some sort of thing where you're having an angel kind of consecrate the thing, there is no way to separate, you know, there's no way to have 100% you know, contamination free sort of thing. So with that said, like, I'm able to understand what you're talking about because I have this magical background. So my question for the both of you now, you know, more conversationally, is sort of twofold. I know both of you have been explicit that you've practiced Golden Dawn sort of stuff, and you at least the tradition. And I'm very interested to know how that maybe prepared you for the work, or if it didn't happen as a precursor, how did it expand your work? And then the second question would be, you know, where do energetics fit in for you? Do either of you have any kind of, you know, energetic practice, Qigong, things like that?
Sure. For me, really things kind of happened at the same time. So my involvement with Golden Dawn came at the same time as I was I had already started studying both alchemy and magic and, you know, the esoteric in general prior to this. But when I really dove in, I was studying herbal medicine, I was studying spagyrics, and I, you know, had recently been initiated into a Golden Dawn temple. So it was happening all at the same time, which was great. It was an intense experience and really, it was a big pivot point for me in my life, because it took over. It was my all day, every day, in my dreams, when I wake up, all day long, I'm doing one or all of these parts of the work simultaneously. So for me, the interplay between, let's say, influence of Golden Dawn versus my alchemical studies, I'm a very science-minded kind of person, and even more so then. So I was really picking apart the bits and bites of spagyrics and alchemy and figure out how can I pull this into my clinical practice. Like, how can I make this part of, you know, my apothecary practice to make really effective medicine? So I was focused a lot on the practical aspect of the work. But then, of course, at the same time, you know, I'm going to this Golden Dawn temple and looking inward, and sharing this type of experience with other people. And so I was getting, again, a good interplay between I'm doing physical work and honing in my lab skills, but at the same time, the deeper underpinnings of the meaning of the work, not just the how, but the why, was being highlighted by the Golden Dawn work. Right. And of course, it's not the same for everybody, but I had a really great community around me at that time. Everybody was, focused on the mysteries, very, very communal and friendly, very open to, merging these paths. I think at that time too, people felt like alchemy maybe had lost its grip in a lot of these different magical orders, that perhaps in earlier days that this was an absolute prerequisite for this type of work, to be doing this internal work and also this external work at the same time. So I think there's a lot of hunger for that, at least in the group that I was in, to kind of connect the dots and bring alchemy back into this work, not just in a, the way that Jung approaches it as a system of psychology or mysticism, but, actually bringing physical laboratory work into it to add to our tools, was mentioned, making magical tools. I think everybody, understood, even without maybe having experienced it, that it was obvious that alchemy could produce substances that would be very, very useful in let's say the Golden Dawn tradition or any other ceremonial magical tradition.
Nice. Yeah, and I guess, for me, it was something that I felt obligated to learn so that I could speak the language of a lot of Frater students. So I didn't really get that interested into Golden Dawn work until maybe, because I was practicing spagyrics for 2 years before I even knew it was part of the alchemical tradition. Then I started studying. That would have taken me to about 2006 or seven. So yeah, I didn't really start studying alchemy until about that time. That was the first International Alchemy Conference. And shortly thereafter, I would hear all sorts of people at the conferences and at other Yahoo groups referencing, the 4 = 5 degree, or, just all sorts of random type of esoteric. You had to be in the know in order to understand what they were talking about. And so for me, it became a very intellectual pursuit of going through that. And I think it was 2009, I inherited an entire library that had all of the Golden Dawn materials from her local temple that she was at, and all of the, I have a tremendous amount of books over there. especially authors who were part of the Golden Dawn tradition, who went on to teach various things about Kabbalah and other related things. So at that time, I kind of got into it, but I it didn't take me a whole lot of time to realize that I'm not a big fan of 19th century occult revival type holdover magic. I did never find it effective to the greatest degree, at least in comparison to the magical forms that I'd already been practicing for years up to that point. And so I was just kind of highly critical of it, to be perfectly honest with you, and didn't really enjoy it. And I had to sift through so much of it just to be able to understand the references that a lot of people were making. It was my time with most esoteric orders has been kind of frustrating that way, to be perfectly honest. Rosicrucians, Golden Dawn, things like that.
It's a fairly common complaint. You know, I would say it's about a 50-50 split. You know, people really are into it, or they're really like, I don't get this.
I love the essence of it, though. You know, like the background of it is like all of the things that I thought I was getting myself into by like joining, or, and then I quickly found out like actually I already have a lot more insights just by using some of the framework from like Jean Dubuis courses in understanding Kabbalah in the lab and the Tree of Life in the laboratory, even though I have to admit, like a lot of his framework cannot be replicated or necessarily taken a look at as being absolutely scientific in the majority of cases. His ideas on that served as an excellent framework for me. And I felt like I was getting a lot more from that self-initiation than I did from any external esoteric order, because there was just, I was guiding it. I was the one, like, if the work worked, then that was proof of the initiation to the next phase of the work. And if it didn't, then I can't move on. Like I have to redo this. I'm still in this process.
Something I just thought of too, you know, I share your frustrations, and I think a lot of people do in modern times. And, you know, it's not to put down the essence of these groups or anything, because, yeah, I looked at something like Golden Dawn and I thought, okay, this is a whole bunch of subject matter that I'm really interested in. And look at all these pivotal characters who were part of this group or part of groups that came before it or after it. And obviously there was something attractive there. You know, my time getting into it, really, I wasn't a, let's say, believer or anything. It was more academic for me. Like, why do all these important people spend all this time in these places? I was curious, you know, and a lot of the, you know, I had encountered a lot of these aspects of, let's say, Golden Dawn work before. But something that I found right away, and what was interesting about my experience at the time, was that my deepest experiences, not all of them, but most of them, happened outside of the Golden Dawn Temple. And it was because I was merging my work with alchemy and imbibing substances with the work. And not to say that that is a prerequisite or anything, but I think if we look at the history of you know, these hidden traditions, they almost always have something that you're taking. You know, if you look at the Greek mystery schools, right? One of the longest lasting traditions where everybody wanted to go and drink the Kaikion. There was ritual. Of course, there's all this aspect of ritual or ceremonial magic, all these, you know, pieces, but it all centered around something that was imbibed, you know? And I think there's something to be said about looking to nature for aspects of nature which are maybe further ahead in their evolution than ourselves, right? When you look at the perfection of nature and plants and minerals and metals and how we can manipulate them to make them humanized and make them, you know, usable by the human body. Like, to me, like, those are the true elders of this type of wisdom. It's not just people. And of course, people can be elders too. And I've learned so much from people, but the number one teachers for me have not been human. They've been plants, they've been minerals, they've been metals. And I feel like the combination of these systems, whether it be magic or philosophy or any type of esoteric thought, combined with, you know, these strong leaders of plants and metals and minerals, that combination, to me, I've never witnessed a single system that separates those things as being more powerful than the parts combined. Again, back to the idea of alchemy, right? Pulling all of the parts together, gets the best results. And that's certainly the way it's been for my experience, at least.
That's very interesting. I wonder if either of you, or maybe both, you can tell us where does the continental European alchemy and spagyrics world stand nowadays? Is it very different from North America, or is it on the same scheme, or do you have any experiences with that, contact with people over there?
Yeah. So I have actually trained a number of people who live in Sweden, one who lives in Greece. I have a lot of colleagues in France, actually, Devenir d'Estelier. We also have, I don't know. There's actually quite a few different colleagues that I can think of. Alexander Diener, who is in Switzerland. So the traditions are actually very, very similar, especially because, you know, we have to go back to the late 19th century, like 1880, basically. And we take a look at all of the different esoteric orders that were forming the biggest Rosicrucian and esoteric movement that actually made its way to America was happening in France. And it was definitely the Kabbalistic Order of the Rosy Cross, or the KORC, that had the largest number of participants in that same vein who were studying the works of like Fulcanelli and actually performing a lot of work. And that's the tradition that kind of made its way to America during during the 20th century, especially through the works of Jean Dubuis. But you can see that even Frater Albertus's tradition, which had, according to Rubafila Solfluer, originated with Alberto Pancaldi. And Pancaldi was in Switzerland and had that same type of French KORC influence. And so we find that there was kind of a very similar tradition. And even though Europe just in general takes things on a more serious level, everything, like, I don't know about your work, Daniel, but like my work is like, I had no credentials. I didn't have millions of dollars behind me to start my practice. Like, I was bootstrapping everything and learning as I go and starting my own business out of necessity, because there's nobody who's going to hire a spagyrist. That was not something back in the day that people were looking for. So yeah, for me, it was definitely like, I had to find my own way. And in Europe, a lot of these guys, they come from traditions where they got interested in something who had been passing, you know, in somebody's tradition who had been passing it on for a long time. They tend to learn from those types of sources. And then it's a passed on tradition. And it's something that is also done as a business with kind of more or less communal support. Like, there are people who know about it inside of the community, and they tend to support it more. So that being said, there is a lot of younger folks in Europe right now who are practicing alchemy, and a lot of them are just like living out of a van, or, you know, like living van life or whatever they call it these days, and doing things like that. And so there is a lot more of that kind of American influence in Europe from my perspective at the present moment, but it seems to be much more on lockdown in Europe too, especially because in Germany and Switzerland, for instance, you have the electro-homeopathic pharmacies that are, you know, essentially doing very alchemical things, if not the exact same way as the American tradition, but they're selling electro-homeopathic remedies in, you know, apothec in the apothecaries and stuff. And so it's just more serious in Europe.
I've spent lots of time in Europe and have been blessed with making many contacts in different parts of Europe. And I would agree that the European side of this seems like it's more of a unbroken tradition. A lot of what we're learning from, of course, came from Europe, you know, maybe earlier before that, Middle East, or even, you know, North Africa or Asia. But it's obvious to me that there's more lineages of unbroken tradition. I think if you go back to, let's say, the time of Frater Albert is trying to learn things a little bit more difficult. The more I hear about, you know, Frater Albertus's early days, it seemed like he was quite frustrated with trying to find good teachers early on, because most people were entirely focused on like psychological alchemy, and he felt like they had, most streams had lost the laboratory practice. That being said, knowing how secretive many alchemical groups can be, I think, you know, going around knocking on doors kind of thing, it might be a difficult way to get into some of these more secretive and continued lineages, right? Because now we see, as things start to open up more, we see that there are some unbroken lines of people passing down laboratory alchemy in Europe. They're just coming to light a little bit more. So we don't have that here as much. We've had to kind of forge our own path. You know, it's something that, you know, wasn't here as far as the European alchemical tradition. You know, Frater Albertus really, I think, is the person who opened up that door, and, you know, he did the best with what he had. But most of his work was spent, you know, it seems like most of his time in the alchemical field was more of what he had created and going with the life of what he initiated himself, rather than, okay, I spent, you know, decades and decades studying under certain tradition, and here I have the complete system, and here it is. I think he had to do a lot of back engineering. You know, it seems like he obviously had a very good understanding of the basic principles, and although he may not have had the initial teaching that he had hoped for, you know, when he was, you know, left Germany and I think went to France afterwards, and he was searching for people to learn from. At least from what I've read and what I've heard from people who knew him, he didn't really get everything he wanted to. So again, he had to focus a lot on kind of back engineering these ideas, you know, rather than coming from an unbroken tradition, he was creating his own. So I think there's a lot of criticisms about that, and some founded, some unfounded. But that is really the big difference, I think, between, say, the Americas and Europe, is that this is a relatively new thing here, where it's a little bit more unbroken when you look at Europe in general.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, though. You know, to kind of combine what you had both mentioned earlier about, you know, different lineages and traditions in terms of magic versus alchemy, or in terms of what you were more called to. And along with this idea of having to try and make your own way, I think a lot of what we're, and I'd like to hear your thoughts, but I think a lot of what we're trying to do is tap into a particular stream of consciousness. And I think a lot of what we, you know, we need to sort of have a degree of consonance with the thing that we're looking for. And we're able to sort of find the threads, find the clues that bring us to where we need to go. Now, I personally tend to think that a lot of our story arcs are somewhat providential, especially when you begin engaging with them in this way, you know, and in an enchanted world and things like that. But I think that it's possible to tap into something, even if you don't have a teacher necessarily. You know, I don't think it's completely impossible to tap into somebody like that who's you know, running all over Europe and really, really sincerely trying to find the tradition. Like you kind of mentioned, Daniel, there's some criticism about there being gaps and him not trying to, you know, him not being able to get everything that he wanted, but having to sort of retrofit or kind of put his interpretation on the thing. I think that can really be an effective way to transmit, but also evolve a system and kind of keep it, you know, as long as you have the nuts and bolts, the basics, and you know what you're doing. I think that can be a really interesting way in which these systems sort of providentially evolve. I mean, does that make any sense, or is that a complete non sequitur?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think something that helps me keep going when you're lost in this sea of information and you're, you know, diving into like who's right and who's wrong and gets a little bit cloudy, I think what I try to remember is that this is a system of following nature. at its, you know, so regardless of what book you have, what person you have teaching you or anything like that, the truth of it is all around us all the time. It's inside of us all the time. And I think there's something to be said about having this genuine, it's like a childlike experience where nobody's held your hand or anything, and you're having direct experience with like the revelation of truth relative to your own personal journey with it, right? You know, when you don't have it all laid out, you know, on a silver platter for you and you have to go find it yourself, like it hits hard, you know, and sure, along the ways. And like, I think we've all probably had those moments where we have what we believe to be an epiphany, which maybe 10 years later, we might look back and laugh at that epiphany and think that wasn't really much of an epiphany at all. But I mean, in that moment, it was pivotal and it changed you, you know, and then you move on and you evolve further and go deeper into your experience. So I think, yeah, there's something to be said about forging your own path and having this more direct experience, you know, when you don't have a teacher to ask you, and you're just, you have that like undying urge to uncover the truth, you know, nature reciprocates, right? And we all have our own, you know, individual way of uncovering these secrets, but they're there for us everywhere, all the time, inside of us. You know, there's no lack of resource when you tap into that particular way of learning. And I think there's something special about that.
Something that's interesting for me is having to do kind of what you were talking about just now in terms of this reciprocation or this reciprocity in nature, and something that you said earlier about your best teachers being being plants and minerals and things like that, tying back to maybe like the Rosicrucian perhaps influence on you know, them being highly inspired by Paracelsus. I mean, if you can say one thing about early Rosicrucianism, is very, very influenced, you know, to heal the sick and that gratis, using magical means as palliative, as medicine for the soul. There's this other concept too that, you know, Phoenix mentioned, the intelligence of plants. In certain magical paradigms, the Rosicrucian lineage specifically claims that, you know, the Rosicrucian order extends, you know, it's visible people and invisible entities. And that includes things from the highest, you know, aspect of that ontological chain, talking about, you know, things that would be considered angelic or archangelic, and things all the way down at the lowest level, you know, I don't know how low it goes, but you know, it struck me as being really powerful that, yeah, because even on the magical side, when you're not necessarily imbibing things or taking things all the time, we believe ourselves to also be under the tutelage of you know, angels, daimons, you know, gods and things like that. So there is, you know, nature, I think one of the beautiful things about our traditions is that it can encompass so much more. You know, it's a hierarchy that not only descends into visible nature, but invisible nature. So I that kind of struck me, and I thought that would be something to contribute there.
Yeah, I also thought that it sounds very much to me, I don't know if I'm right, to this life, what you mentioned, Daniel, to and not to the beyond in a way. So it's very much oriented into practice and here and now. Is that correct, or did I misinterpret you?
Yeah, I think it's this it's definitely a here and now thing. But although that reverberates maybe before and after who we are, where we are right now, you know, I think it's all connected, of course, but yeah, I think it speaks to the experience that we're having. You know, we have this universal spark of life and intelligence that animates everything, crammed inside of this individual, unique body, and the pairing of those two things creates this very unique experience of something universal. So I think, yeah, there's a here and now aspect about that for sure. And I think, you know, like Ike was saying too, like whether you're whether you're imbibing something or not doesn't really matter. I think we're surrounded by this intelligence of nature, and when we open ourselves up to it, like inevitably we will meet it where we need to, when we need to, on our own personal journeys. I think it's just an inevitable aspect of it. Same thing back to the question about initiatics. You know, healing is initiatic, right? Whether it's a headache or something, you know, like a horrible life-threatening illness or injury or something like that, healing is initiatic. And I mean, again, it speaks to this premise of alchemy where we are removing these impurities, removing these obfuscations of the truth of the matter. And whether we be, let's say, deeply into like ceremonial magic or religion or philosophy or anything like that, we could be a totally, you know, materialistic person. I think inevitably when you start clearing pathways, let's say by taking a medicine in the body, you know, you start to clear the bathroom mirror a little bit, inevitably you have initiatic experience because you're opened up to truth and reality in a way that you were not before. It's like, you know, you fine tune your radio and therefore more flows in, or it flows in a different way. And, you know, whether you, you know, would label that initiatic or not, you know, I think in essence, that's what it really is. That's what I love about this system too, is it's so natural and it's so holistic. Yeah, I keep coming back to that word. It's doesn't matter which angle we go at it. In the end, it has the same effect. I think it changes us.
Well, healing means becoming whole again, right?
Exactly.
Right.
I'm interested to hear, Phoenix, maybe you can go first, but how do you think, and this this might be a little controversial, right? It's not always popular to sort of insinuate that communities can improve, but I'm wondering how you think the community of practicing alchemists, modern alchemists, how can they best continue to grow and improve, you know, or at least from your vantage point, what are you trying to do to facilitate that? And what are you seeing as a response right now?
Yeah, well, for a long time, I mean, the alchemical community has been a weird thing because it's grown so much since I first got into it. And there was a point until maybe 2018 or somewhere around there, where my goal was to get everybody together to be able to create a single system of standards that could be used, because there were so many folks learning so quickly from sources that were questionable sometimes at best, or that had information that maybe was not agreed upon by the vast majority of existing practitioners. We all tried to kind of look out for each other and give people like a heads up. It's like, hey, a lot of people can do what you're doing. Maybe you shouldn't be doing what you're doing for a reason. Like, there are a lot of reasons why we may not want to put, say, oils of metals available online just to anybody, anywhere. And there were a lot of concerns. And that got so misplaced for a long time that it drove like a wedge and some competition inside of a lot of different groups, and it things got highly contentious for a little while, and everybody was disagreeing. Quickly, I realized, well, this isn't sustainable at all. And so my whole mission and vantage point changed, which was, how about I just create my tradition? And then whatever is going on in the broader community at large, they can do whatever it is that they want to do. And in my tradition, I love opportunities like this, like listening to Dan, learning from Dan, listening to John H. Reed, learning from John H. Reed, listening to, you know, Robert Bartlett, learning from them. I like as many different perspectives as possible. And so that's what has led to me creating kind of my own synthesis, my own tradition of things. And that can be a lineage for my students if they want it to be. And if it's just one flavor of the multiple different flavors that they're going to experience in the alchemical community, then so be it. I mean, that's absolutely fine. But at least they know where each different part of the teachings that they want to assimilate kind of came from. And there's also going to be historically a bit of a definition as well, and some context for that, because we don't always have that when we look back at history today, alchemical history. We don't always know, like, when a group of followers started following one particular way of things. We don't, unless there was like a very particular text or author that they were using, we don't know how to like trace that back. And so both for historical context, as well as just to be like, okay, cool, whatever is going on out there, that's fine. Here's going to be my tradition, my lineage. If you want to learn this way, I'm here. And I think that that's going to kind of be the future of a lot of things, whether formally spoken or not formally, just the way things are going. Like, you always hear about in the United States, it's like, I learned from Robert Allen Bartlett. I learned from Sage of Popham. I learned from Phoenix Aurelius. You know, I learned from Inner Garden. I learned from, you know, all these different sources, John H. Reed. You'll hear different types of things like that. So there already are these lineages anyway. I'm just trying to make it maybe a little bit more pronounced, and then bringing standards to my own way of doing things, my own approach, my own answer, my own.
Daniel, where do you see the thing going? What would you like to see going?
Again, I feel quite similarly to Phoenix. I think that it's important right now, if we want to bring alchemy out to the world, out of the shadows, and really see what it can do when it's available in a way that it never has been before, there needs to be checks and balances. There needs to be a standardization to some sort of degree. I'm an eclectic person, so I'm never going to vote for one single standardized system that, like, there's only one way to learn alchemy. This is the way it is. It's such a vast subject, alchemy. It's like to say you've got all the answers for alchemy is to say you've got all the answers about life, right? I think many hands make light work, and we need to have many different opinions and many different approaches to really, again, tease out what the truth is. But in moving forward in today's modern paradigm, if we don't want alchemy to be pushed back underground through, let's say, well, there's dangerous aspects of alchemy, like Phoenix mentioned, you know, you could have toxic products, especially if you're working with metals and minerals, but also even with plants as well. So I think there is a need to standardize that aspect of it, whether it be quality assurance standards, or also just standards of operation and understanding of, like, how this works and why this works, why this medicine for this and not for that. So there's a depth of clinical practice with it too that I think deserves standardization, even down to very simple things like, you know, how much of an ingredient is in this preparation that I'm taking. If I take 5 drops of this, what's the equivalent, you know, raw ingredient or active ingredient? Like, you know, I think standardization is necessary to research properly, to understand the full benefits of this and to really analyze it under a tight scope. And then there's the safety aspect of it as well. And also to hand something tangible down to whoever comes next in all of these ideas, like to have something like a really strong framework to start with, so they could build upon that and evolve it even further. You know, I think right now, I think in the last, whatever, let's say 100 years of alchemy, it's been a lot of labor trying to uncover, like, super cryptic, poetic, symbolic, like, all these, there's so many layers of hiding the bare bones facts of alchemy, right? And I think that we're entering a time of revealing where it's naturally starting to come more out in the open in order to take the next stage in its evolution, whatever that may be. So standardization, I think, is a really, really important thing. And just for the record too, you know, to have, again, something really strong to start for anybody new to it to start from, to either critique or build upon or validate further, we need really strong data. And I think we're creating it maybe for the first time, because before it's all scattered, it's different practitioners of different ages, different parts of the world, no internet, much more difficult to travel. Like, there's all these impedances to, like, a shared body of knowledge. And now we don't have any of that. So to create that, even if it's multiple systems, like Phoenix has his system, or, you know, Robert Bartlett is teaching his, which is, you know, very, very open in my opinion. There's many different schools of thought, but I think to standardize whatever school of thought you're coming from, to put it on the record, to compare, contrast, build upon, is a really important part of making this available to the world right now. And it's a very unique opportunity that alchemy never really had before.
And we are really grateful, both of us, to have you had with us here to start off with this new joint venture that Ike and I have decided to try out. And I think we're looking forward to what's coming in the future. But thank you so much for being with us here today. And it's been great. Ike, what do you think?
Excellent. Thank you so much, both of you guys. Thank you, Rudolph. If you do have any websites or anything you want to point people to, I think now would be the time.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Yeah, so for anybody who's interested in my work, you can go to phoenixaurelius.org, and hopefully there will be a link down behind there, because not everybody spells that right on the first take. At any rate, yeah, phoenixaurelius.org, you'll be able to find out about the research that I do, the calendars I put together, all of the products that we make, classes that I teach, different types of things like that. And if you enjoy our mission, what we do, feel free to support us. We can always use that, because alchemical work and spagyric work is neither cheap nor easy. And so all of your funds definitely help. Thank you.
For myself, you could find my work at secret-fire.com. Also on social media, on Instagram, I have a more personal page, alchemia.arcadia. And then I have my business page, Secret Fire Apothecary. So you could find my work there. I teach classes and offer a lot of products and services. And you can find all of that on any of those platforms.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It was a wonderful opportunity. And thank you for all of the awesome thoughts that you also shared today, Dan. I always learn just as much from you as I do from being on and listening to everybody. I mean, it's a really fantastic exchange of ideas.
Likewise. Thank you.
And there's only one thing I would like to add. Take care. Stay tuned. Hear you soon.
will answer on my seating bones. But yet the answer came from a black pond. Hope he spoke my name. But I search a lilac crumbling for a gleamer and a ball. Cherry-picking memory and choking off the stone. Molding dresses swaying from the branches on the bridge. And the seaweed around my arm are tightening. Call of the solstice been bright at all. The mirror of it all will shatter and the pieces fall.